Good afternoon, and thanks for joining this Yahoo Finance Plus conference call. My name is Jim Kelleher. I'm Director of Research at Argus, and I'm here today with Argus Director of Product Strategy, Steve Bigger, along with Senior Energy Analyst, Bill Selesky. You know, Argus does a lot of conference calls and on different sectors, and we hadn't done an energy call in a long time, and that's because the sector's kind of been out of favor. Investors turned away from fossil fuels, as you see in the title, for a variety of reasons. The first of which was, you know, energy used to be synonymous with fossil fuels or petroleum. Now there are a lot of environmentally friendly non-fossil sources, and the rise of solar and hydro and wind, and the rise of EVs, electric vehicles, has contributed to the perception that peak energy has passed. And then finally, energy really got knocked on the chin when the pandemic lockdown left vehicles stranded in driveways and city streets, not being driven. And we actually had negative futures for energy. But obviously, things have changed since then. Now note, and later in the presentation, we'll take a look at a chart showing how the peak sector weight within the S&P 500 has come down sharply. At one time, up in the double-digit percentages, and then at the worst of the pandemic, energy was less than 2% weighting in the S&P 500. But the pandemic has had consistently unpredictable side effects, and one of those side effects has been, with the post-pandemic economy roaring back to life, demand for all kinds of fossil fuel products, gasoline, aviation fuel, heating fuel, every kind of distillate. Demand is just absolutely spiked, and insufficient supply is pushing prices higher. Energy companies cut production in 2020 amid sinking prices, but they're now thinking about a step up in their E&P budgets, and Bill is going to talk extensively about the go forward for these companies as they consider, you know, how to plan for a sustainable future, because they are also aware that with the rise of catastrophic climate events, there's intense pressure to move beyond petroleum-based fuels. And at this critical point in time, investors really want to know if the recovery in petroleum-based energy is real or just a sidestep on the road to a petroleum-free future. So that's kind of our topic today. And Bill will discuss that, and our Steve Bigger will provide the Q&A in a fireside chat format. Before we get there, though, what we like to do is kind of survey where we are in the economy kind of as we come into the final months of the year. And I'd like to begin on the next page by talking a little bit about some of these charts here. We have a GDP forecast, a Treasury yield curve, something on S&P earnings, and you can see how the market is distributed. In terms of where we are with GDP, I think the key message of a third quarter GDP report is that the government-fueled phase of the pandemic recovery is over, and we're about to find out what the private sector can do. You know, from the third or fourth quarter of last year through the first two quarters of this year, we had extremely strong growth, above 5% in all those quarters, obviously, more like 6% plus in the first half of this year. And then U.S. GDP growth slipped to 2% in the third quarter. So that partly reflected, you know, both a normal step down, you know, kind of the GDP growth is measured quarter over quarter, so it's up against a tough comparison. But also we saw a COVID spike and really kind of interfere with the reopening on a kind of state-by-state basis. And then with the kind of wind down in federal stimulus payments, it's no surprise that the government, you know, fiscal stimulus slowing really contributed to a slowing in overall personal consumption expenditures, private inventory investment, and also non-residential fixed investment, which is another way of saying capital investment. So our full year GDP forecast is going to be in the, you know, kind of 5% to 6% ballpark, with a lot of that growth having come in the first half of the year and the first, you know, but we do look for a fairly good fourth quarter, stronger than the third quarter. We're seeing a reacceleration in the jobs economy. The U.S. economy added 531,000 non-farm jobs in October, and we've averaged about 582,000 jobs per month for the full year. We've also seen, one interesting side effect of the non-farm payrolls report we're seeing is that wages are rising much more rapidly than they have in a long time. That's contributing to inflation, as we'll talk about in a little while. But it's also helping those hourly wage earners who've been waiting years and years for some sort of rise in their living standard. So we're seeing, hourly wages up about 5 to 6% year over year. That's the best growth since the 90s. It's overdue growth. And these people are now able to contribute to the economy. So that's helping overall spending and helping overall GDP growth. And that's going to be a long-term effect that'll continue well beyond, whatever the change in monthly payrolls is. Beyond the jobs economy, the housing economy continues to downshift. The industrial economy is operating below potential, mainly because of the global supply chain crunch. And the consumer economy is being powered by job gains and rising wages. We saw retail sales this morning, or was it, I think it was yesterday morning, rise 1.7 month over month. That's reflective of these higher wages and new hires across the country. That's very, very positive going forward. If we take a look at the trend in interest rates in the Fed, we're just seeing that rates are generally higher but uneven. Short-term rates remain low, although it's only a matter of time before they begin to climb again. The middle of the curve moved higher in October, and you can see yields on the 2 and 5 year, that's the pink chart, moving up quickly, whereas the yields at the long end really barely budged and in fact came down a little bit. This creates what's called a moderate flattening in the yield curve, and economists associate a flat or negatively sloped yield curve with a rising risk of recession. And I would say what we'll probably see is the long end start moving up again as inflation intensified. And the concern about recession is really, it's not there yet. We don't see that kind of slope in the curve. It's just something to keep an eye on. The Fed has now announced their schedule for tapering in their QE program. Unlike in 2013, when the market responded with a taper tantrum, the investors appear to welcome the upcoming tapering. The Fed's balance sheet is seen as being dangerously bloated. And investors learned in 2013 and 2014 that the market was able to shrug off tapering instead of collapsing, which is what had been predicted. Take a minute to look at earnings growth. Earnings for the third quarter were terrific. They certainly moderated from the first half pace, but earnings have broadly exceeded expectations in every quarter of 2021. And we've also seen that in the third quarter earnings, the magnitude of beats against consensus was higher than usual, and the number of companies beating consensus expectation was also higher than usual. Most interesting about this year's earnings performance is that last year's earnings laggards are this year's earnings leaders. For example, we take a look at some of those cyclical recovery and wealth in the ground beneficiary sectors. That would include industrials, materials, and energy. Industrial earnings were up over 70% in the third quarter. Materials earnings were up about 90% year over year. And energy earnings were up 160% year over year in the third quarter. That's actually quite a step down from almost four-digit growth in the second quarter when they were comparing against the depths of the pandemic lockdown. As the third quarter earnings season winds down, we at Argus will be revisiting our EPS expectations for this year and next with a bias towards higher estimates. For now, Argus can share that our 2021 earnings estimate is $191 per share for S&P earnings from continuing operations, and our 2022 estimate is $214 per share. Now, why do I mention it? Not only Argus, but a lot of people use some sort of inflation-adjusted earnings model, earnings yield model, to determine fair value in the market. So when you're able to plug higher earnings forecasts into your model, that really makes the model show less of an overvaluation that you would normally get in a steadily rising market. So elevated earnings forecasts, along with retracement in the stock market in September, which kind of reset the clock, they create a more attractive valuation scenario heading into the what's now going to be the final month and a half of the year. And quickly on that index distribution there, if you were to look at the index distribution map from a year ago, you would see energy even smaller, down, you know, it's almost 3% now, it's about 2% now. You would see financial services a couple ticks lower. You would see technology somewhat bigger, and you would see communication services somewhat bigger. But we've actually seen a rotation in the market into interest rate beneficiaries like consumer services, cyclical beneficiaries like real estate and industrials, and wealth in the ground inflation beneficiaries like energy materials. So the map has changed a little bit, but you can see the Argus favored sectors are indicated in green there. So let's move on to the next page. We'll talk a little bit about the indexes in the U.S., overseas. We see those markets on the bottom, and then on the upper right, sector performance year to date. I'll talk a little bit about what's been going on here. So we always like to see a lot of green on the screen, and when you have seeing this much green on the screen, these are year-to-date performances. Further gains into year-end tend to become a self-fulfilling prophecy because investors know that they can't maintain bearish positions or they're going to get, you know, killed by their investors. So we see money managers capitulate to the bullish case, and that usually gives the performance in November and December, making it the best two-month period of the year typically. I want to note that look at that left chart and how closely correlated the returns are here. And this has been the market's best friend. If you were to look at this chart from a year ago, you would see NASDAQ way out in front. You would see Wilshire large cap value way behind. You would see a really disparate market. You'd see the Russell small caps 2000 getting killed. This year, they're all moving together in lockstep. And that's one of the things that's really been the market's best friend here. Similarly, on the sector side, if you looked at this a year ago, almost all the mojo was in technology, consumer discretionary, and communication services. This year, you can see the last year's laggards are up front, energy and financials, and real estate, and everybody else is participating, and only two sectors are up in single digits for the year. Why is this important? When you have a broadly advancing market like this, you've got a lot of sector rotation going on throughout the year, like a tag team wrestling match, and it keeps everybody fresh and healthy. It means the broad market is broadly advancing. Percentage of stocks above key trend lines is at a very, very high level. And similarly with the global equity markets, most of the global equity markets are working. And I think what you're seeing there is, particularly in the developed world, there's lots of places where there's not widespread dissemination of vaccines, but many places are finally starting to catch up with the rest of the world with the dissemination of the vaccines. There's a little bit of herd immunity being developed. And most of the global themes that we at Argus look at are all in good shape, whether that's mature economies, whether that's the Americas, whether that's resource economies. The one thing that we have lagging year to date, as you can guess, will be BRIC, and that is because two of the letters in BRIC, Brazil and China, are deeply negative for the year. Now, before I hand it over to Bill, I want to take just a minute to talk a little bit about what's going on with inflation on the next page. So there's lots of good things in the market right now. There is a growing reopening economy. There's growing earnings. We finally got a bit of bipartisan progress, however limited it might be, and the infrastructure bill. So there's some definite positives in the economy, mainly the reopening momentum. But there's several big challenges. We have rising interest rates. We have this global supply chain issue, and we have inflation. And inflation is a difficult. It's very difficult to look past it. I know a lot of people on Wall Street are starting to worry, not about the year end 2021, but what's going to happen in 2022 if we can't lose this inflation. So in the kind of early pandemic period, the concern was about recession. That's been completely eradicated and replaced by concerns about inflation. And inflation, we think, is being driven by a perfect storm of factors. So production shut down during the pandemic. And then recovery has been more rapid and stronger than expected. At the same time, the workforce, and this is not just true in the US, but worldwide, the workforce has struggled to get enough people back to work. In particular, baby boomers are choosing early retirement, and a lot of women have not come back in the workforce. In many cases, they're raising children on their own, given the high cost of, or unavailability of childcare. Another key cause of the kind of hike in, so you've got shortages of not just goods and labor contributing to higher prices in this perfect storm environment, but you've also got a digital transformation underway because things that required minimal electronic content now require massive electronic content. Let me give you an example. An EV or an electric vehicle has twice the bill of materials, electronic-wise, of an ICE car, an internal combustion engine car. And according to the CEO of NXP Semi, which is they are the leading provider of automotive semiconductors, the production of hybrids and EVs went from 6% of the 2020 global build to over 20%. Now, most of that is hybrids, not pure EVs, but this is an irreversible trend. So you've got all these forces driving prices up. Rising inflation does tend to correlate with rising interest rates. Rates are rising, but we're thinking that in the U.S., the still low nature of global rates is acting as a depressant on our rates, really kind of running out of sight. We still have a 10-year yield that is well under 2%. Now, we're all capitalists here, right? Capitalist economies eventually solve supply-demand imbalances, and at some point, demand will more closely align with supply, and that should help the inflation story. Until then, however, we are likely to see inflation run well above the Fed's 2% annual target range. Now, one of the major contributors to inflation has been rising petroleum-based energy prices. So this seems like a natural point to hand off the call to Bill Seleski. Bill?
Okay, thanks, Jim, and hello, everybody. Today, I would just like to spend a couple of minutes bringing everyone up to date on our thoughts about the energy sector and why I think the positive momentum in the energy sector will not just continue through the rest of 2021, but will also continue during all of 2022 as well. So let me begin. On the page, Sector Outlook, we all know that today the energy sector only makes up a small part of the S&P 500, about 3%. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at chart number one on page six, energy sector weighting, you can see how small the weighting is today, from 13% in 1990 to 12% in 2010 to 3% today. The point being, it's still only a small part of the S&P 500. Now, switching back, but if you were to go back to 1980, this sector actually comprised about 28% of the S&P 500. I mean, back then, you had five or six gigantic energy companies in the index, but through energy company mergers and a historic pattern of outspending cash flows, energy companies fell out of favor with investors following a typical boom-bust cycle. But in 2021, things have changed. Why? Well, you know, simply put, oil prices are rising on stronger global demand and lower industry supply, a simple case of demand being greater than supply. Let me explain why we think demand will continue to outstrip supply for at least the next 12 months. But first, we raised our sector weighting to market weight from underweight on September 7th, and we did so primarily from a valuation standpoint. The sector went through a brief downturn during the summer months of July and August, and we saw the opportunity to get a bit more aggressive on our rating, as we believe that valuation in the sector was still far from being full. As a matter of fact, today the sector is still trading below pre-pandemic levels on valuation, and we still see upside of 20% or more in certain energy names. That's why we stepped it up. But just as a heads up, we no longer believe that owning a basket full of energy stocks is the way to invest here. We think it's getting more difficult to find out performance, and we recommend owning select names in energy. We now believe it's become a stock picker's market. As for performance, last year back in 2020, the energy index finished down 37%, the worst of all the subgroups in the S&P 500 index. The underperformance was largely the result of weak crude oil prices, mostly related to the effects of COVID-19. However, so far in 2021, the opposite has happened. Investors want to hear about energy stocks, and we believe the biggest reason is the price of oil. As a matter of fact, take a look at chart number 2, page 7, crude oil prices from 2007 through 2021. The chart shows the big swings in oil prices from the sharp drop in 2008 due to the recession, the supply glut in late May. That was when the shale boom happened, and a massive drop in March 2021 due to COVID. Since then, with the global recovery underway, the uptrend in pricing has been slow but steadily higher. Now, switching back. Now, last year at this point in time, the price of crude oil was $41 per barrel of WTI, and today it's 79. It was 80 earlier this morning, but today's a bad oil day. So what happened? Well, you had oil companies significantly cutting production in drilling budgets, a recovery in global GDP following the lifting of pandemic restrictions, and OPEC Plus sticking to production quotas and not flooding the global market with oil. As it turns out, we're going through something that looks pretty close to a perfect storm. That's where we are today. The energy index is up 55% year to date, and the S&P 500 is up about 25%. We expect this gap to continue for the rest of 2021 and through 2022 as well. Let me continue. Okay, back to performance. Leading the sector is the subgroup exploration and production, known as the E&Ps, which are up 90% year to date. The big oil names, the integrated oil companies, are up 49%, while the refinery segment is pushing 34%. Rounding out the bunch, the OFS stocks, oil field service and equipment names, and they're up 37%. Now, a large part of this outperformance is simply due to the level of profits the oil industry is currently generating. It's massive and largely based on the price of oil. But energy companies over the years have cut production, CapEx, headcount, SG&A, exploration expense, and a bunch more. Now, during this upturn, the individual companies themselves are in such better financial shape and could do so much more with so much less that profit growth is phenomenal. Now, if you take a look at chart number 3, page 8, energy profit rebound, and look at the year-over-year comparison from 2Q20 to 2Q21, those top 10 have gone from a loss of $2.8 billion to a profit of $25.7 billion in 1 year. I mean, it can't get much more dramatic than that. So that's where we stand now. Let's switch back. All right, going forward, we believe the OFS stocks, the laggard in the group, will start to see better relative performance as E&P budgets continue to strengthen. Our updated 2022 forecast calls for domestic E&P budgets rising about 20% year over year, while international E&P budgets should trend in a positive 10 to 15% range. This creates a positive environment for the OFS providers. As a result, we recently upgraded Halliburton to buy last week, following 3Q21 earnings results. Now, on the subject of historical perspective, as I just mentioned, in September, we raised our energy sector weighting to market weight from underweight, primarily due to a valuation call. We saw outsized opportunity for outperformance in several energy stocks. More recently, 2 weeks ago, November 3rd, we increased our average oil price forecast to $75 per barrel, with an expected trading range of $50 to $80. I know that WTI is trading at the top of this range today, but at the same time, we believe that oil prices will continue to remain exceptionally volatile. The upgrade in our price forecast was due largely to what we saw as improving supply-demand fundamentals and a positive industry environment. Energy industry conditions improved towards the end of the summer of 2021. Global inventories are now at the low end of historical averages. Global demand remains strong, and OPEC Plus continues to maintain a controlled increase in production. As a matter of fact, when OPEC Plus met this past October, they agreed to keep their gradual approach philosophy, restoring output slashed during the pandemic by agreeing to only add 400,000 barrels per day beginning this month in November. Keep in mind that in the past, OPEC Plus usually had to make a choice, support prices for the short term or defend market share for the long term. These tended to be mutually exclusive, but that is arguably no longer the case. Continued strong oil prices are evidently in OPEC's best interest. At the moment, we believe that OPEC Plus can keep the market tight without fearing a non-OPEC supply response. Therefore, we suspect OPEC Plus will manage the market very carefully during 2021 and 2022, and we look at this management manipulation as a significant positive factor in keeping oil prices elevated. OPEC Plus is in unified agreement. OPEC Plus also, a few weeks ago on November 4th, and as we predicted, did not make any changes in their output plans. Remember that this group agreed in July 2021 to boost output by 400,000 barrels per day per month until at least April 2022 to phase out 5.8 million barrels per day of existing production cuts, already much reduced from the huge curbs that were put in place during the worst of the pandemic. Just remember that the cartel's goal has been to maintain global crude prices at high enough levels necessary to sustain their own national economic programs, with the exception of the fallout in crude oil demand that took place as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, the group has been quite effective in achieving that goal. For us, we believe that energy demand will be stronger for longer, following the easing of COVID restrictions, low crude oil inventories, OPEC Plus compliance, and subdued oil and gas production plans for the IOCs, NOCs, and most, if not all, of the E&P companies out there. Additionally, shareholders today demand stronger capital discipline from energy companies. These energy companies will see little in the way of equity ownership by institutional players if they begin to produce oil at rates like they did in the past. Also, shareholders today demand higher cash returns, particularly in the form of higher dividends, stock repurchases, and a deleveraging of balance sheets. We think this sets up another strong year in energy stocks. Okay, with that, let's turn to looking ahead. Now, all but one of the energy companies in my universe have reported earnings this quarter, the only exception being Helmerich & Payne, an oil services and equipment provider who reports their fourth quarter and year-end results after the close today. However, the takeaways from the third quarter are the outlook remains encouraging, demand is still outpacing supply, crude oil inventories are at the low end of five-year averages, OPEC Plus appears intent on balancing the oil markets, and energy companies remain disciplined in their capital spending plans and are increasing production minimally in the 2 to 3% range, not 7 to 10% increases like in the old days. In addition, as I just noted, investors demand higher returns from oil energy companies, no matter what subsector they play in. In addition, rig count demand remains positive and continues to trend generally higher, which we consider another positive factor. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at chart number 4 on page 9, U.S. oil rig count demand, and look to the far right, since the pandemic in March 2020, the rig count has shown a slow but steady uptick in demand. We see it staying that way through 2022. Now, let me go back. What that suggests to us is get ready for higher dividends, maybe more variable dividends, share repurchases, and improving balance sheets through debt paydowns. Today, most energy companies can support their CapEx plans and base dividend payments at $50 to $55 WTI, assuming no fundamental company-specific issues. Oil is $79 per barrel right now. So, to summarize, our stock picks in energy no longer focus on owning a basket full of energy names, but rather on a stock-by-stock basis, which is the definition of a stock picker. We look for those energy companies who have what we believe is a competitive advantage. In our mind, those with superior balance sheets, reliable and growing dividend growth potential, low break-even levels, and expert management teams. We believe this is the best approach in this current environment. And finally, the last two bullet points underscore the subject matter of clean energy. Now, after months of intense debate, Congress finally approved the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill on November 5th, and it was signed into law this past Monday. This is a so-called traditional infrastructure bill, the one designed to upgrade the nation's roads, bridges, pipelines, ports, broadband, railroads, power grid, and other public works. Our interest in this bill is how it addresses the electric vehicle or EV industry. This infrastructure package contains $550 billion in entirely new investments including money for electric car charging stations. As a matter of fact, $7.5 billion is allocated for the funding for EV charging stations across the country. Today, the U.S. has about 40,000 plus charging stations, and the Biden administration has set a goal of having half of all new cars electric by 2030, which will obviously require significantly more charging stations. Independent consultants have estimated that the $7.5 billion is a small fraction of the amount needed to build out a robust national system. Some estimates begin at $50 billion as to the amount needed to build a U.S. charging network that would be able to serve the number of electric vehicles expected by 2030. Keep in mind that costs for EV chargers vary based on the level of the charger. The higher the level, the quicker the charge, and the more expensive it is to install.